Recording has started. Came through.
Okay, so hi everybody. This is the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference call for July 19th, 2023. And we're, let's see here, I guess I'll start with the roll. We have, so far, we have myself, Craig McKee, we have John O'Malley, we have Barry Zwicker, Roland Engel, Mike Cook, Frank Tolopko, Fern Tishman, and Richard Gage. I don't know if we'll get any more, but more people, but that's who we've got on so far. I guess the first thing that we would do then is just to make sure to see if there are any objections to the agenda as distributed. Anybody have any objections or any additions or changes that they want to propose? Okay. All right. So hearing none, I'll take that as approved. So that brings us to our first speaker of the night. That's Roland Engel, and he is the chairman of the board of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and he's an engineer and has been one for more than six decades and has owned, I think, three of his own companies, engineering companies, and he's going to be here tonight too. He's been on our call before, so we're welcoming him back, and Roland's going to talk about the engineering cover-up of 9/11. And also a particular project in that direction that he's involved in right now. So I don't know any other details, Roland, that you think that you'd like people to know that I didn't just mention. Feel free to throw those in. But so what I'll just hand it over to Roland, and you can tell us all about the project and about the engineering cover-up.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on, Craig, and sure. Glad to have the opportunity to inform people about what our latest work is all about. And it involves the explicit explanation for what we know has happened on 9/11 in regards to the three buildings, World Trade Center, Twin Towers, and Building 7 that came down on
9/11. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I apologize. I'm just wondering two things. I'm just thinking I should have put it into lecture mode, which would mute everybody else. But I also wonder, are you possibly on a speakerphone? And if so, yeah. Is there any way you could go off that? Because the sound quality is not spectacular.
Okay, well, let me see if I can do that. Maybe I should hang up and call back in because I don't see how I can do that offhand.
Well, you could actually, the way you're sounding now is okay. I think as long as you're loud enough and clear enough, then I think we're okay. It just sort of seemed like you were a little bit far from the mic there for a moment, but
yeah. Okay. Is this better?
Yeah, you sound good now. Yeah, you sound good now.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, once again, thanks for having me on, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell people what we're doing these days, and I think we're involved in some very exciting stuff. We have now been investigating this issue as an organization going back to 2006 in that neighborhood. And we've done a lot of essential research on the explanation that the government has given us as to why the Twin Towers and Building 7 in New York City collapsed that day. And we found those explanations to be completely without merit in terms of providing an explanation that the engineering community can agree upon. So we put together a presentation on our findings, and we call it Project Due Diligence. We've been taking it out to the rank-and-file engineering community across the country and are in other countries, too, actually. This was done after we had approached the – here's the problem. Let me lay out the problem as quickly as I can. The problem is that the engineering profession's leadership, that is the leaders of the engineering organizations that represent our profession to the public and to the government, which consists of a half a dozen professional organizations, some of which have been around for a long time, the most prominent of which is the American Society of Civil Engineers, which was founded in 1857 and is the most prominent of all the engineering professional organizations in the United States. But there are others that have come along later, the National Society of Professional Engineers, the National Alliance of Forensic Engineers, the Structural Engineers Associations, and several other smaller ones. These organizations, the leadership was incentivized in some manner to endorse the reports that the National Institute of Standards and Technology issued, explaining or purporting to explain why the Twin Towers and Building 7 collapsed in the manner in which they did on 9/11. Now, the way that they were able to do that was that they went to NIST. Well, first of all, let's back up a little bit. Congress only agreed to have an explanation presented or investigated after many of the families of the victims that died that day put intense pressure upon them to find out why the buildings collapsed. So Congress passed the National Construction Safety Team Act in October of 2002, about a year after the event, and they put the National Institute of Standards and Technology in charge of conducting this study or studies to find out why the buildings came down. Now, that was a conflict of interest. And the reason it was a conflict of interest was because the National Institute of Standards and Technology is a branch of the Commerce Department. And the Commerce Department is an executive agency under the executive branch of government, as is the Department of Defense. So the Department of Defense was charged with our safety and preserving our safety that day, and they failed to do so. As we know, almost 3,000 people were killed in those attacks. So by empowering NIST to conduct the report, they were actually asking one agency of the executive branch to investigate the activities of another agency. So that's a conflict of interest, because obviously political pressure can be brought to bear. Nobody wants to look bad. There's going to be a lot of effort made to cover up mistakes. We know this, and this is not a good policy. What they should have done, Congress should have created a separate board, agency, or commission to study the events, as they did with the 9/11 Commission, which did not go into the reasons why the buildings collapsed and was also compromised. And the people that led that commission later even complained that they thought that the commission had been set up to fail. It doesn't mean that they couldn't have set up a commission to look at the building investigations to fail as well, but it was surely set up to fail by having NIST conduct the investigation. So that was problem number one. Once NIST took over the investigation and FEMA had done a preliminary report, as they always do when a natural disaster or a terrorist attack occurs. They had made a preliminary report, and they submitted that in the spring of 2002, and NIST took that as a starting point, and NIST proceeded to turn around and hire a bunch of contractors to do a major part of the work involved in the studies. And a lot of those people, of course, were people that had longstanding ties to NIST, had done work for the government before. These were major contractors, major engineering and architectural firms. They had longstanding ties with the government. And so they worked with NIST to produce a report. And the reports were flawed. And we can follow the logic of the reports. The one on the Twin Towers was released in late 2005. It's about 13,000 pages long. The one on Building 7 didn't come out until 2008, late in the year. It's over 1,000 pages long. And those reports, as we began to sift through them and look at the details, we found a number of anomalies. In fact, we've identified at least 23 decisions that were made in the progress of conducting those investigations that were not based in scientific principles, that avoided evidence and distorted evidence and made analyses that were not correct. And so these reports were flawed. And we issued a call for a new impartial investigation. And so these reports have since been validated by the leaders of our engineering profession. In other words, ASCE, NSPE, NAFE, and so on, all came out and said, well, we stand by the NIST reports. We don't think there's anything wrong with them. They were all done in a scientific manner by professionals and experts in their field, and we think that they are good to go, and there's no reason to look any further. And they have secretly engaged in a campaign of slander against us by calling us a bunch of conspiracy theorists and intimating strongly to their local branches that they should not invite us to give our presentation to their members. So since then, we started project due diligence to carry this effort out in 2018. The last 5 years, we've made presentations to about 50 different organizations. And in the process, we've presented our information to more than 1,000 engineers. And that information has been unanimously approved by the engineers in the sense that they all agree that there's something wrong with the NIST reports, they don't meet our professional standards, and we need to have a new, impartial, and hopefully unbiased investigation to clarify the problems that we have pointed out. So the stonewall continues. NIST continues to refuse to respond to our requests. The leadership of our professional organizations refuses to respond to our request for a dialogue about these matters. And at the same time, we know that when we are able to reach their members agree with us and not with their own leadership. So we have a contradiction that has developed between the leadership of our professional organizations and the rank and file of the people that are aware of these problems within our profession. So at this point, while we continue to push forward and have our presentations, for instance, we have another one scheduled next week in Florida. It's going to be made to the Florida Engineering Society and the American Contractors Association. And they are open to what we have to say, but in many cases, we've been approved for presentations and they've later been contacted by influential people in our professional organizations, and then we've been turned away. So this is a struggle that's going on as we attempt to reach enough of the members to make a difference. And as a way of explaining what's going on to the public, we're now putting together a book. And the book is called Engineering the 9/11 Cover-Up, How the Evidence of Controlled Demolition Has Been Hidden from the Public Since 9/11. And so we're going to explain this process. We're going to go through all the nuts and bolts of what our evidence is, what our experiences has been with the professional organizations, their places where we've made presentations, the experiences that we've had being turned away after initially being accepted. We're going to then look at the people that worked on the NIST reports, many of them from private contractors, and we're going to look at the decisions that they made, and we're going to name them. We're going to say, well, we know that this individual, for instance, was working for NIST. We know that he worked. This is all public information. You can get it off the Internet, which is exactly where we got it. It's not super information that's been leaked to us by anybody inside NIST or inside any of these organizations. This is all public information. You can find it in the FEMA document, and you can find it in the NIST reports. They name the people that were involved in these investigations. So we're simply making that information known to the public. We're saying that we know that somewhere within that group of people must be the people that made the critical decisions that derailed the investigations and prevented them from coming to conclusions that were consistent with the evidence. So this report is kind of this book is an attempt to put more pressure on NIST, to put pressure on some of the people that actually were involved in the investigations, to perhaps get them to come forward and tell us what they know about the internal workings of the investigations. And we hope that this is going to help lead us up the chain of events from the evidence to the people that examined the evidence, to perhaps the people that influenced those people that were making the investigation, because we feel that's the best way to bring down the perpetrators. We hope that some people, you know, this has been 21 years now. Some of these people are retired. Some of them have already died. We're hoping that at this point we can get people to come forward that know people that were involved in the actual investigations, and they can give us some idea about who were the people that made these 23 critical decisions. How were those decisions arrived at when we know that they were not consistent with scientific evidence and a good engineering practice? So that's the next step in our drama here, and we will continue to work with our rank and file engineers and encourage them to encourage their leadership to engage in the dialogue that has always taken place in the engineering community whenever a disaster or a catastrophe occurred that involved engineering work. There's always been an effort, a cumulative effort by the organizations and the profession to look at that evidence and come to some kind of understanding as to what really happened. That hasn't happened with the buildings at the World Trade Center. So we know that we've got a group within the International Mechanical Engineers Association that has been studying the report that we had produced by Professor Halsey at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, which was issued in 2018, which his conclusion was the NIST model didn't work for Building 7. The only way he could get the building in the model to behave as it did in the actual event was to remove 8 floors of all the columns in the building simultaneously. That's the only way you could get it to drop straight down into its own footprint and destroy itself on the way down. So he did not agree with the NIST report. NIST has not responded to that. Nobody in the academic community of any note has responded to it. So it's become sort of a taboo subject in the engineering world. We're hoping that the publication of this book, by naming some of the people that we know were involved, will encourage some of them or maybe others who know something to come forward, and we can continue to follow this trail of evidence. So that's where we are today, and that's what our activity is all about. We, of course, always depend upon the public to support us. So if you can support us, we are looking for small donations on a regular basis so that we can plan our activities accordingly. We would encourage you to go to our website, ae911truth.org, and donate if you can. Inform yourself. There's a lot of information that I've been only able to just skim over here that's included on the website. And we're hoping that we'll get enough support to continue to pursue this matter as we move into the future. So with that, I'm going to, you know, that's about all I've got to say about what we're doing at this point. And I want to give you the chance to ask questions and make comments, and I would open it up for that right now.
Okay, great, Roland. Thank you very much for that. I end up muting everybody sort of one at a time because I didn't want to interrupt. So bear with me for just a moment while I sort this out, because what I'm going to do is unmute everybody, and then I'm going to try putting it into Q&A mode. And that's when basically you need to type *6 into your phone, and that automatically puts you in the queue. If that doesn't work, I know Cheryl in past months has had some trouble with it, and if it doesn't work, then we'll just do it the old way, the old-fashioned way, where people just sort of say that they'd like to be put in the queue, and we'll figure it out. But just give me 2 seconds here while I unmute everybody one at a time. And maybe in the meantime, everybody can think about what they would like to ask Roland. Okay, getting there in 2 seconds. Okay, everybody's unmuted, so let me just put it into Q&A mode, if I can figure out how to do that. Okay. I've got it. Okay. Okay, so it seems to be working. So *6 to get in the queue. So we'll just see who does that. In the meantime, Roland, I'll just throw this. Yeah, I know you've sort of covered this very thoroughly, but I think, you know, a lot of people may not. They may not realize how important the engineering side of this is, in the sense that, and I think the point I've heard you make before, which I think is an important one, and maybe you can just kind of reinforce this or whatever, is the idea that the official, you know, the official story is maintained, and the possibility of getting a new investigation is kind of blocked because of the supposed credibility that organizations like NIST and the ASCE have. And so people that are being asked to investigate this can just sort of hold up the fact that, you know, that the official agencies have already, you know, handled it on a scientific level, and that's sort of used. So that's kind of the reason I gather for why you're targeting that to kind of break through that. Did I characterize that fairly? Sorry. I have to unmute Roland. Give me 2 seconds, Roland. Sorry. Oh, bloody hell. How do I get back to that? Okay. All right, okay. Here we are. Roland, are you...
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now. I finally figured it out. So, yeah, did you hear my question?
Yes, I did. And that's a very important point. I want to reinforce it. Thank you for bringing that out. NIST, of course, was charged by Congress and is an agency of the government to conduct the investigation to find out why the buildings failed and how they failed. Now, NIST, when questioned by us, turns to the authorities in the engineering profession and says, what do you think? And the authorities come back to them and say, we think your reports are fine. And NIST then says, well, then we don't feel that we have to answer any of these other questions because we have the authority of the engineering profession backing us up. Well, that completely ignores the fact that a lot of those same people that they're asking to confirm the report were people that worked on the report because they were hired as contractors by NIST to do certain aspects of the report. So, yes, they're going to confirm, even though they may have only done a small part of the NIST report, they're going to say, well, yeah, we participated and everything we did was cool. So, yeah, we think the reports are fine. And as long as NIST is able to go to the engineering professions and ask them if they support the NIST reports and they say yes, then NIST is home free. They can say, why should we have to answer any questions when the authorities in the engineering profession support what we did? So we understand that the leaders of our own professions are the roadblock. If we could somehow magically get them to reverse their position and tell NIST, no, we don't stand behind your reports, then NIST would be in a completely different situation. Then they would be out there all on their own, and they would be under tremendous pressure to have to answer our questions. But as it is, they can simply hide behind the leadership of our own profession, which is supporting their efforts. So that's why we're focusing on our own professional leadership, because we know that's the first step. Unless we can get them to change their position, NIST is always going to be able to say, they don't have to answer our questions either.
Right. Okay. Great. Now, I don't know. I'm not. There's nobody in the queue right now, which surprises me. So I'm wondering if it's something technically that I'm doing wrong. If it's not, then please, guys, come up with some questions. I'm thinking maybe just to be on the safe side, I'm gonna exit Q&A mode just in case I'm doing something wrong, which is entirely possible. And then if anybody is looking to ask a question.
Hey, Roland.
Okay. Yeah, Mike, did you have a question you want to ask?
No, not a question, just a thank you. And you're on the right track, and I think it's going to be lawsuits. You know, I mean, unfortunately, what else we got?
Well, can I respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Can everybody hear me? Can people hear me?
Yes, they should. Yep, everybody should be able to hear you, yeah.
Okay, that's a good point, and obviously, one of the things that we in our system, we believe that going to court is sort of your last hope at trying to get some relief. And the courts, we are presently in court. We're in front of the federal appellate court in the District of Columbia with a case against the NIST establishment. And what happened was that after we had discovered problems with their report, we're talking about this is specifically the Building 7 report, we submitted what's called a request for correction to NIST. And by law, they have to answer that. Congress has passed what's called an Administrative Quality Act, and that act requires federal agencies, when questioned, to respond to those questions. If they publish the report and somebody gets back to them and says, I don't believe this or I disagree with that, then they have to respond. They have to come back and say, well, here's why we said that, And they either have to change their opinion because based upon the new evidence or the argument that's been presented to them, or they reinforce their original position. So we went with them. We went to them with a request for correction, and we had 8 separate items that were involved with their report on Building 7, and we questioned each and every one of those 8 conclusions in their report or those findings. And they came back to us and simply reaffirmed their original position on every one of those 8 items. So we then took them to court. We went into the district court in the District of Columbia, and we said to the district court, look, here's what they said. Here's what we said. We believe that our arguments prevail, and we believe that they are not responding in the manner which the AQA Act requires them to. They're not responding in a meaningful way. They're simply repeating themselves. So then the district court ruled that essentially they came down with a ruling which is very bizarre. They came down with a ruling that said, look, although the agencies of the government are required to issue a report, they are not, those reports don't have to be truthful or accurate. So
wow. Wow.
So that's,
really? They said that?
Yes. That's what it says. In so many
that's
words.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Do you know about the 3 boxes?
The 3 boxes?
Yeah. We have, as law-abiding American citizens, the ballot box, the jury box, and the cartridge box.
Yeah. Okay. I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this is getting obscene. It's really obscene. I thank you for all your work. Thank you.
Okay, well, I just want to let you know, we are appealing that decision, although I was against it, but we have other plaintiffs that joined us in that lawsuit, and they wanted to appeal that decision. I am afraid, so now it's in front of the appellate court, the federal appellate court in Washington, D.C., and I am nervous about that appeal, because if the appellate court affirms what the district court ruled, then we have just gone to all this trouble to establish a very bad legal precedent that is now citable in other cases, in other matters, and essentially lets all government agencies off the hook for having to tell the truth or be accountable for what they've done.
I've got a very good engineering joke. Would you like to hear it?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay. So all these engineers are sitting around talking about what kind of engineer God must be, all right? So the mechanical engineer says, well, you look at the bones and the muscles and the tendons and ligaments and everything, the way it works. Yeah, God was a mechanical engineer. And the chemical engineer says, you're full of shit. We're just a bag of chemicals, okay? All we are is a bunch of chemical reactions, and God was a chemical engineer. And the electrical engineer says, well, you know, that's all true, but the things that make us really human are all these minute electrical impulses in the brain. So God was an electrical engineer. And the civil engineer says, you're all wrong. You're all wrong. It's God was a civil engineer. And they say, why? Well, because only a civil engineer would put a waste disposal system right through the middle of a recreational area.
Jesus Christ.
Well, he had a good argument there.
All right, good. That's a good one, Mike. Would somebody else like to ask a question?
I have got one here in Toronto.
Go for it, Barry.
Yeah, Roland, you mentioned 23 critical decisions, and I was just wondering if one of them or one or two of them are particularly outstanding or egregious that you could pick out.
That's a hard one to answer because they're all bad. Now, some of them are more detailed than others. For instance, in some of the structural elements of the structure that they said failed, they simply left off stiffener plates that would have strengthened the connection and made it impossible for the sequence of events to move forward. Some of them they actually lied about important information. For instance, they claimed that there was no decision, there was no water to fight the fires in Building 7. And that's not true either. There was plenty of water available, but they decided not to use it for some reason. And so then they claim, of course, that fires brought the building down. So the fact that they said, well, the fires existed because we didn't have any water to fight them, and they knew that there was water to fight them, and they decided not to do that, is an indication that they wanted to use the fires as an excuse to say that that's what brought the building down. Some of them are really egregious in the sense that they didn't do what the law required them to do. One of them was to test for incendiaries. So in a case when a building came down in a suspicious manner, the fire code explicitly tells the investigators that they must test for incendiaries. And, of course, if you've used incendiaries, that is cutting charges or explosives, to bring the building down, then there's going to be residue in the debris, and it's going to be, you can detect that with chemical tests, and that's one of the things that the law requires. Well, NIST did not do that, and they have no, the reason that they give for not doing that is because they said, well, if they had used explosives, there'd have been loud explosions, and they would have been heard a mile away, and we didn't hear anything like that, so therefore we didn't test. Well, that's completely irrelevant. The law required them to test for incendiaries. They did not do so. So in some cases, what they did was an absolute violation of the law. They ignored a lot of evidence about explosions that occurred in the buildings before the planes hit, or in the case of Building 7, early that day, and the building didn't come down until later that afternoon. So that's important information that would have indicated controlled demolition. They messed around with the thermal loads. They exaggerated the thermal loads on the building from the fires by constructed their own fire modeling system, and they used that to analyze the fires. And in the course of that, they committed a lot of erroneous, fraudulent in regard to how much the building was heated and when it was heated and so on. So, yeah, there's a lot of the other stuff was just leaving off structural details. And so
sorry, there's somebody making some noise in the background there. Can you go on mute or whatever? Sorry, go ahead.
But anyway, I would say in the book, we will go through each one of those 23 items, and we will explain what they ruled and why it was not plausible. And then we'll go into the people that we know were involved, that were involved in making those decisions, so that we can sort of single out individuals, not single them out, but at least put a group of people in the room that we know were involved in making that decision, so that we can isolate the 23 decisions into 23 groups. Of course, some of the people are in more than one group, but at least that way we know who we want to talk to about what, and then we'll begin to ask those questions.
Very good. The ones you mentioned alone are scandalous, and it's great that that individuals will be held accountable.
Well, we think that's the only way that, you know, I mean, otherwise this is just going to be a question that's never answered in history, and eventually all the people that were involved will be dead, and it'll be impossible to prove anything.
Yeah. Thank you, Roland.
Thank you.
This is Paul Zaremka.
Anybody, any other question?
Paul Zaremka.
Paul, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, just something I really don't understand about the project as a whole, and I, of course, I respect you for all your work, and yet I don't know that I agree. I just cite Upton Sinclair that it's impossible to get a man to understand the truth if his salary depends upon not understanding. And I think that holds true for the courts. So I don't, I mean, how do you respond to that? You know what I'm trying to say.
I know exactly what you're saying. And of course, that's at the center of the problem that we're facing. I don't, personally, I think that we spent a lot of time and effort trying to run down a lot of things that turned out to be dead ends. And I think the whole approach to the courts is futile. I don't believe that's going to give us any answers. I think what we need to do is put pressure on our professional organizations, because we can prove, and I know this for a fact, we've been out, we've talked to more than 1,000 engineers. Every single one of them agrees with us. When we present engineers with this evidence, they understand that we are telling the truth. We have an analysis that makes sense from a scientific engineering perspective, and they are willing to admit that. And they say, yeah, we need a new investigation. The problem is that the leaders of our organizations are economically tied to the government. And that's exactly what you pointed out. It's hard to convince a man to say one thing when his salary depends upon him saying something else. And that's the problem that we're having. Now, we can either force those leaders out and get new leaders in that are willing to go against NIST and say that we need a new investigation. Oh, and if we can't do that, then we're not going to be successful. That's, in my mind, the only path to any kind of successful answer to the problems that we're facing.
Could I go one step further in my comment?
Yeah.
Of course, the Pentagon Papers were absolutely earth-shattering in the United States, as everybody knows. But that came out in a context of a mass movement against the Vietnam War in North America. And what we don't have about 9/11 is that mass movement. I don't think it's fair to say we do. And so I think it's going to be hard to even get these engineers who agree with you, the 1,000 people who agree with you at the individual level, to create that mass that would take down their leadership. I guess that's my question.
Yeah, well, I think that's obviously a very important question. The question is, this is the 60th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. Now, the official government position on the assassination of JFK has not changed since
Correct.
The Warren Commission report came out. Yet I believe that by far a majority of people in the United States don't agree with the Warren Commission report. And I think that's been pretty well established, and there have been more than 1,000 books written establishing the evidence that would discredit that report. So although I agree that a mass political movement is important and necessary, the question is, how do you get there? And I think the way that you get there, and I agree that we don't have it now, I think that the way that you get there is to be able to point to the profession that are the experts in this matter and say those experts don't agree with the report, with the government's version. And if those experts are willing to stand up and say that, I think you have a chance of building a mass movement around that. But until that happens, and unless that happens, I don't think the mass movement, no matter how large it might be, will have the power to overturn the existing analysis on the official basis.
Okay, thanks a lot. I understand what you're saying.
I've been trying to have a voice. Can you hear me? This is Fern Tishman. Can you hear me?
Hello. I can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
I can hear you.
Okay. Well, I go down to Ground Zero a lot. I wish somebody else would come with me. We need to organize down there. They're building Ground Zero crime site, Tishman Corporation. That's part of my family. If you Google it, you'll find out. He's building Ground Zero to be an entertainment, a performance, and a shopping center. So, I talk to the people when I go down there, and I wear my 9/11 shirt. I have a bunch of 9/11 shirts, and people come and talk to me, and they say, you know, this is like Homeland Security and like Guantanamo Bay, and people know. But I need more than just me to go over there, to go down there and talk to them. And I can say to somebody, these terrorists, they don't have the money to build what's here. And you people at 9/11, you know, Richard Gage, none of you, Barbara, Aaron, you don't even come down to Ground Zero. You don't see what they're doing. You know, well, also, write when people, whenever there's a thing with writing on, like I wrote about how 9/11 happened, and it's a little bit personal to me, but on September 10th, 2001, I write all the time, and I sent two of my documents to a publisher in Alexandria and one in Pittsburgh the morning of September 10th. My mail's a seized, so nothing I do is confidential. Since 1960s, my family properties, Tishman, are related to the assassination. So then the evening of 9/11, Rumsfeld told the people in Pentagon that there was $2.3 trillion missing, and the next day the explosions in the Pentagon accounting office. And then Bush in a public school talking about reading makes a country great. And then the five, Israeli nationalists, he said they were, they knew about 9/11, they're blaming the Palestinians. And then the evening of 9/11, Bush wrote in his diary that, the second Pearl Harbor began. I just came from a thing about against the war, and the whole thing is the same as 9/11. It's not about facts. It's about money. That's what the problem is, money. It's always about the money. And when I was down at Ground Zero today and I was looking at all the things Bloomberg has, so the guy says to me, well, he's the chairman of the 9/11 Museum. So I said, some of it is just horrible, but I communicate because my life is related. Like my family, Tishman built the World Trade Center Twin Towers, and it's related to my own history. But I can't do it by myself, and just I need people to join me. I'm not an organizer. We used to have a group down at Ground Zero. That's what we need. I can't organize it by myself. But nobody even bothers to come down there from our old groups, and even from you, even you people. You could try to come down to Ground Zero and see what they're doing, to see the propaganda they're doing for wars. And they have big globes of Silverstein, and he's bragging about how he's controlling world economy. This is about war. That's what it's about. So, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Fern. Do you want to hold on a second? Sorry, who's speaking?
Mike.
Okay, Mike. Do you have a different question? Because I want to make sure Roland has a chance if she wants to comment on.
I want Roland to respond to that, but I just want to point out something tactically, that there's a lot of opportunities for snipers, okay? Snipers that will just blow somebody's fucking brains out, get away with it. Yeah. You've got a situation there where there's higher altitude positions of plenty and ways and means out of places. So some people not appearing in New York, I think that's really smart. I don't think that's a bad thing. You don't need to be there in New York to protest against what's happened.
Well, let's bring Roland in and see if he wants to comment on this subject of that Fern's raised, and then before we get too much further along, Roland, did you want to comment?
Yeah, sure. I would agree that this is about money and power and criminal acts that have to be covered up in the pursuit of money and power. And so I completely sympathize with your frustration about going down there and seeing that the crowds have died away and people have gone off into other directions and you feel isolated and alone. And that is exactly the way the cover-up is designed to work. So that with the passage of time, people become discouraged. The 20-year anniversary has passed. People are getting older. A lot of people that exist in the world today weren't even born 21, 22 years ago. So they don't feel the immediacy. You have a very personal connection through your family with what happened on 9/11. So the sentiments and the passion that you feel about this issue are not going to fade away in the same manner as they do with other people. What we found working with engineers and building professionals is kind of a strange but not so hard to understand phenomena, which is that the further people are away from New York City, the more critical they are of the government reports. And the people that were in New York City or have some organic connection to New York City at the time or since then, they are the people that are the most hard to convince that this is a worthwhile cause. Maybe the trauma of living through that situation left them in a way that, I mean, there were almost 3,000 people that died there that day. You have a very, very small number of families that are still involved. One reason being that the government paid them enormous sums of money to sign an agreement saying that they would never question the government's version of what happened. There's only a tiny group of that 3,000 people's families who are still active trying to find the answer to what happened. So, yeah, over time, as distance, time elapses, the movement gets harder and harder to sustain. That's why I'm saying we can't count on a mass movement to change the decision that the government has made here. It's not, in my opinion, it's not going to happen. I think the JFK assassination shows that. This is the 60th anniversary. Government position has not changed. I think we could go 60 years after 9/11 with a mass movement. Maybe over time, most people will begin to understand what really happened. I don't think that's sufficient. I think it happens to, unfortunately, fall down on the shoulders of the profession that I happen to be a member of. We are the ones that hold the key, in my opinion. And unless we do our job and are able to convince or displace our leadership and our own leaders and remove our approval the government reports and say, no, those government reports are false. They do not meet our professional standards, and then leave them to hang in the wind by themselves and see if they can withstand public pressure and professional pressure at that point.
John O'Malley. I wanted to let the Mrs. Tishman know that in the DC group, we've had good success in attracting people to events using Meetup, meetup.com. We've been able to increase the numbers in our group, and we've been able to get people to show up at events. So I just wanted to let Mrs. Tishman know that. Over.
How do I communicate with you?
My email is John, as in John, Paul, as in Paul.
Yes.
O'Malley. That's Oscar Mike Alpha Lima Lima Echo Yankee, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y, at yahoo.com.
Okay. Well,
great. Thanks,
yeah, that's really important. And I don't agree because, like, you know, 9/11 was created for these wars. And you know, when I talk to people, they say, well, what about Homeland Security? Like, and then it's going to go into Cop City. And here in New York City, the mayor already has changed the police commissioner so that the cops will have to, you know, follow whatever he says. Cop City is not about the cops. It's about reestablishing Nazi Germany here in USA. And the politicians are the ones that are the problem. And the cops and the firemen have no, they have to follow what they say. Their jobs are in jeopardy. You know, you got to see. And they no longer have white roses on the things. They have fake flowers. You know, it's no respect for any of our people in the, you know, no respect for the police or the firemen or the school teachers or health care. No respect for any of that. Only respect for big money, big real estate investors and war. And so that's experience. Thank you for letting me share. Yep, it's not even about the politicians. It's about money. Oh, it's about money. But we have to face it. It's not going to end. It's never going to end. Never. And it doesn't change anything. The wars aren't going to even change anything. They're just going to make the rich richer. It's not going to change anything. It's not about values or anything like that. Courts aren't going to help. You know, but that's my opinion. It has to come from the people, a revolution, but whatever. Thank you.
Thanks, Fern. Roland, did you want to comment on that, or did you want me to go to the next question?
No, I think I said what I have to say, and there's a lot of truth in what she says. I only hope that it doesn't come to that, but, of course, you know, revolutions happen when things get bad enough.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, who's to say? I would say it's in the best interest of the powers to be truthful, because if they continue to lie and evade the questions that people want answers to, then of course, you know, maybe revolution becomes much more plausible in the minds of enough people.
Right. Now, is there anybody who let me just break it up into, first of all, is there anybody that hasn't asked a question yet that would like to ask? And then if not, then anybody else wants to ask a second question is welcome to do so. Does anybody want to ask a first question that hasn't had a chance yet? Okay. Sounds like not. Anybody else that's already spoken would like to ask something else? Okay, well, unless I'm missing something, it looks like we've got to the end of the question section. I just want to say thank you very much to Roland for joining us, and I will be happy to have you on, and anxious to have you on again in the months ahead at some point to keep us up to date on what the organization's doing and what the you know, especially as the book comes along that you were talking about.
Can I add one thing?
Absolutely. Yeah.
We have set up a system whereby we're using the book to raise a little money as we go along. If people want to get the chapters of the book, the drafts, as they are completed, they can go on the website, and for $35, they can sign up, and they will get the drafts of the chapters as they are released and have the opportunity to communicate their thoughts about the draft, and that way have some input into what the book finally looks like. So that would be helpful to us. And that would be, I think, informative for you and sort of keep you on the line as we go through this process.
Good.
Great. Great. Yeah, that's ae911truth.org. I'm sure most people know that already. But so thanks again, Roland. You're welcome to stay on for the rest of the call if you wish, or you may have other things to do, but it's up to you. So thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Craig. I'm gonna have to leave. I've been busy all day, and I'm, as you can tell, my voice is just about to give out, and I need to get some food with me too. But anyway, thank you for the opportunity. Nice talking to all of you, and thank you for your thoughts. And please keep up the good work.
Good.
Great. Great. Thanks. Thanks a bunch.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. So So we're now we'll go to the second item on the agenda, and this is kind of one of those things that ideally I hate doing, which is sort of making a presentation myself, which happens to coincide with a night when my co-facilitator is unable to be with us, so that means I have to be the moderator of my own item, which is not ideal, but I'll do my very best to be fair and even-handed with everybody so that, you know, everybody can ask a question or have a comment or whatever. And I think what I'll do is just to start is I'll put this into lecture mode. So this will mute everybody except me, I think. So let's do this lecture. Okay. Right. Okay. So I think you should hear me. Let me just double check here. Let me just turn somebody on. Let's see who we got here. Barry, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Good. So I use you as my little test, because I want to make sure my voice is coming through. Now I'm going to mute you again, so then we're ready to roll here. So the reason, I mean, this is just basically to update my remarks from last month, and some of you may not have been on the call last month, but I think a number of you were. And what I talked about, and we also had Adam Eisenberg and Adam Ruff, who joined us for that, and what we talked about was our concerns, and I guess this started with me, I guess, was the new organization that's been formed, the International Center for 9/11 Justice, which is kind of getting a lot of praise, I suppose, and I had some very strong concerns about that and about where this was kind of leading the movement. And so I kind of went over those, and I don't want to do all that again or anything, but one of my concerns was that this new organization kind of brings together three entities. I'm not even going to call them organizations, because they're not necessarily that, but the Toronto hearings the Journal of 9/11 Studies and the 9/11 Consensus Panel. And the one thing that I feel those three have in common, I mean, have many things in common, and many of them are, you know, of the more positive variety, but the one thing that concerns me that they have in common is that they've all played a part in what I would say is marginalizing the evidence that the Pentagon offers us, which is that, to me, I can only say the obvious evidence that there wasn't a 757 crash into that building. And I think there's been, and as I described then, and I'll move past the summary quickly, I promise, but basically I've been critical of a group, which I call a cabal, and feel quite comfortable in defending that choice of word, you know, that includes people like David Chandler, Wayne Koski, Ken Jenkins, Fran Schur, and others, you know, that seems to want to push us just about as close to the official story regarding the Pentagon as they can get, with the little asterisk being that they're not claiming that it was, you know, they're not claiming it was Al-Qaeda that piloted the planes into the building. But pretty much everything else is official story down the line. And I find it alarming that so many people in the movement are prepared to stand by and, I mean, not even criticize this. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, we shouldn't, you know, cast such strong aspersions, but even to criticize it, I'm honestly stunned that all these years have passed. It seems like people in the movement are just, I don't know if they're not paying attention or if they're just kind of too trusting or what, I don't know what it is, but I don't understand why this behavior, which I can chronicle and have chronicled, and there's so much dishonesty involved in what this group is doing. And every time we sort of praise them, you know, just because they say something about the, you know, controlled demolition evidence, which frankly is not really difficult to do for anybody in the truth movement. I mean, we're pretty much unanimous on that point in terms of the fact that there were some kind of explosive devices used to bring those buildings down. You know, there's lots of disagreement about the finer details, but I mean, we all agree to that. So the fact that certain people that I'm concerned about, you know, are, you know, helping to make the case for controlled demolition, it doesn't mean that they're doing good, that the net effect on the movement is positive. So now the update, I guess, is, and Richard's with us, so I'm sure we'll hear his thoughts on this, but Richard posted an article on his website where he, you know, talked about this new organization and praised it and referred to, you know, it's the people involved as being well-respected and influential, and I think he said that the three organizations, you know, have received far less attention than they should have really received. I'm not sure, you know, how they missed out on attention. I mean, I thought they were pretty well known, but you know, so I felt that this was not a welcome thing because, you know, among the people who are behind this new organization are people like David Chandler and Kevin Ryan, who have been part of this group and who have attacked and, I mean, really defamed the group, that the duo citizen investigation team that has been has provided such incredible game-changing evidence regarding the Pentagon. These people have spent about the last 15 years as a group. Not every member's been at it 15 years, but they've really gone after this duo with a ferocity that I don't see a lot of criticism of that. You know, it's funny, I get loads of criticism because I you know, people say, how can you be so negative about people like David Chandler? Well, you know, I've explained why. what I can't understand is why people are not, why they're not critical, and why they're not specifically, why they let that group get away with some incredibly horrible attacks. You know, they don't ever seem to get taken to task for that. I don't mind taking the criticism because I think it's, you know, what I'm saying has to be said. But it's funny how nobody seems to notice, you know, what that group has said about this, about the group, those of us who are kind of standing up on this Pentagon issue. Anyway, so I wrote a comment on Richard's, at the bottom of Richard's article, and the fact that he was promoting the group, which I think, you know, elevates David Chandler and company in a way that's, it's not good. It's not good for the movement that, that people are giving this guy credibility. I think he's just about the most divisive and toxic person in the movement. And I know people would, some people would call me that, but, you know, I'm prepared to defend why I say that if anybody ever asks me. So I had a big problem with that, with the general reception that this new group got. It even started to, I started to get the feeling that it was kind of, you know, it was being promoted, really pushed. Like, you know, I just got an email from the Colorado 9/11 group, which has Chandler and Franchure in it. And, you know, it referred to this organization as a powerful new organization. And I thought, what the heck does that mean? Powerful. Like, why? And Richard, in his own article, refers to it as having a big stick. And I'm thinking, well, what is so special about this new organization? It's just kind of a rehash of three that have already been there. And, you know, it includes also, I mentioned Ryan and Chandler, but it also includes Elizabeth Woodworth, who, you know, in her work with the consensus panel, you know, has really effectively blocked any serious consideration of whether a plane hit the Pentagon or not. In fact, she's admitted to me directly that she, in an email, that she, you know, they never even considered the thing, that point. And as I may have made, the point I may have made last month, is that, you know, the consensus panel, the way it's set up, you know, you only needed four votes to nix any potential point. And given that there were four members of this group on the consensus panel, that's Chandler, Jonathan Cole, Franchure, and Dwayne Dietz, you know, that's basically veto power for that group. Any Pentagon point, even if Elizabeth had been open on the Pentagon, which she isn't and never has been, you know, even if she were, those people could block any point. And if I can't, you know, see how anybody, any kind of honest truthers would not be at least concerned about that, that very important structural problem with the consensus panel. And we have a couple of people on our call tonight who used to be on the consensus panel and have had their own concerns about it, and maybe they'll want to comment on that. But so that's okay. So I guess in the case, just to finish off, I guess, my concern, and I mentioned this in my comment to Richard, my concern was, you know, Richard put his name to a statement in 2011, which was entitled Complete Withdrawal of Support for CIT. And I'm sure, I think I've heard Richard say even publicly that this is not something he wrote himself, but it's something that he was pressured to write or encouraged to write or whatever, and then put his name to. But it's basically from that group. And it caused a lot of harm. I feel it caused a lot of harm because it stamp of credibility or authenticity to this Chandler group that they didn't deserve. And nor did I think that the criticisms of CIT in there were, nor did I think they were merited. And I didn't even know until after I'd written the comment that Richard has got this 2011 statement on his website, his new website. So he's made a decision not only to not withdraw it, which I think is honestly what he should do, but he's decided to, to include it on his new site. So I guess that means he still stands by it. So, that's a problem. And I think it's a problem, and the other thing I would point out too, is that, Ted Walter is the executive director of the new organization. And he, he was fired from AE. And, what I'm concerned about, among several things, is that, Richard with his new entity, and he's, he's out there raising funds for himself. Ted is, doing this, and that organization is going to be raising funds for its work. And I don't want to see us split our efforts to the point where we have, instead of having one strong organization like AE, and an assortment of other organizations, that we will end up having, three or four that just can't achieve the same things that AE did once. Because if the fundraising is split up, then certain things are just going to be more difficult to do. That's my concern. I hope that people who were giving to AE will continue to do so. Whether they give elsewhere, that's a personal choice. So, I think we need to be a little more discerning. When a new thing like this comes along and it involves certain people who have a track record in the past of suppressing the Pentagon evidence, and keep in mind, as I pointed out last month, this group and Chandler in particular, they make an effort to get their fingers into virtually every entity in the movement, either attack it or they try to control it. They control Scientists for 9/11 Truth. They obviously are in a very strong position in this new organization. They weren't so successful with Architects and Engineers. And I think, although they made, they made an effort to do that too. These are my concerns, and this is sort of the update. When I saw that thing on the Colorado thing about powerful new organization, and that group is sort of holding up the new group as something to donate to. I don't see anything on those emails reminding people that Architects and Engineers still exist and that it, needs to function as well. So this whole thing is kind of making me uncomfortable, this idea that wow, we've got this wonderful new organization, and all it is kind of three old ones kind of put together, and it's another opportunity for prominent people in the movement to bolster the profile and the credibility level, or the apparent credibility level, of somebody like David Chandler, who I think has done such enormous harm along with the rest of his group. So I'm going to stop there. Let me just mention one quick other thing. When the new group was announced, and it was on the 9/11 War Room podcast, a month or more ago, one of the things that was said is that the Journal of 9/11 Studies would not take any more material on the Pentagon, even though they've got several papers from people that support the bulk of the official narrative, people like Frank Legg and John Wyndham, but they're not prepared to have more papers that might contradict those. They've kind of directed people to the debated topics forum, which I think is kind of a bit of like, it's a token thing. It's like, well, that's where all the controversial stuff gets fought over. And the only reason that the Pentagon is controversial is because of David Chandler and his group. That's why it's controversial. It's not really controversial. It's all contrived. And I think it's time for the leaders of this movement to stop coddling this very problematic group of people. And I think, you know, to see the Pentagon evidence essentially taken off the table because so many people think, oh, I don't want to talk about that. It's too controversial. I mean, this is a very orchestrated thing, in my opinion. It's very contrived, and it's been pretty successful because there's a lot of people that simply, you know, just don't, they don't even want to talk about the Pentagon because they think, oh, we're just going to fight over it. They don't realize that some of the people involved in that fight may not be authentic, and they may be trying to get that evidence taken off the table because, as I've frequently said, you know, it's the Pentagon that, you know, if there's no plane crash at the Pentagon, or if there's a faked plane crash, that like absolutely implicates the government without any way around it. So anyway, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to stop there, and let me just see. Boy, it'd be great if we could do Q&A mode. Let me try that one more time, because then I don't have to get involved in sort of deciding who goes when. Let me just try that. Oh, wait a second. What's going on? Get back with everybody. Okay, so let me just do open mode then. Okay, so who would like to ask a question? Is there anybody that would like to go into the queue and we'll just go one at a time?
Greg, this is John.
John, yes, go ahead.
Now, if you have some background in psychological warfare operations, which you can actually get fairly easily by going on the web or YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
They always do this. I mean, they always will use this psychological operation technology or practice to target the target organization, which in our case is the Truth Community, to cause disruption. And the fact that they're still running this operation over, you know, more than 20 years just tells us that 9/11 is still worth talking about because they appear to be scared. Over.
Thank you, John. I think you're absolutely right. And it's funny, I just had a conversation with another truther just yesterday, and that person made the exact same point. They said this thing has been going on, it continues unabated all these years later, and there's no way they're going to infiltrate and try to use a, you know, psychological tactics against the movement if they don't think they need to. If they think we've already been defeated, you know, they may not feel that they need to do that, but they are doing that. And so I think your point is absolutely on the money. If anything, I mean, it's hard sometimes, especially 22 years later, it's hard to find the positives in what we're trying to do, you know, to stay positive and to have hope that, you know, something's going to happen. But maybe that is an indication that, you know, it's a way of us realizing that, yeah, we do have to keep going, because if they're still willing to do this and go to these lengths, then, you know, they must think that we have something, you know, we're some kind of a threat to this official story. So, yes, I think that's an excellent point. Are you good, or did you want to follow up? Or?
Well, I mean, I work there. I mean, you know, the plane is far too big for the hole. There's no wreckage outside the hole. The lawn that would have been dug up by the two engines is pristine. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
it's a slam dunk, and it's like, I even get tired of talking about it. be honest with you.
Well, yeah. Well, listen, believe me, I can relate to that because I've talked about it a lot over the years. And the fact that I still feel that I have to do that is why I do it. Not because I'm obsessed with the subject or I, you know, I have some personal vendetta against some of the individuals involved. I couldn't possibly care less about them on a personal level. I think the whole Pentagon, honestly, I think the whole Pentagon thing is, it's so obvious that it's absolutely stunning to me that anybody with any level of time spent in the movement can still either support the other side or kind of be undecided. Because, I mean, how does a plane crash into the side of a building, go into a hole that's not big enough, without leaving a single piece of a large piece of wreckage outside? No tail, no wings, no. It's a joke, I think. Anyway, yes, I thank you for your question. And is there who else would like to ask?
Craig, I have a comment.
This yeah, sure. Yes. Sure.
For those of you who may not be aware of the different theories involved in the Pentagon sets of evidence, a year ago, I hosted a Gail and I hosted a conference. It's 12 hours long, called 9/11 Con, the Pentagon, and we had Craig and his team provide their evidence for no plane at the Pentagon, and we had Barbara Honegger provide her evidence for a plane that was destroyed approaching the Pentagon. And we had David Chandler provide his evidence and Wayne Costi of a plane that did hit the Pentagon. And we had Thierry Meyssan resurrected after, gosh, 15 years or so, with his evidence for a missile hitting the Pentagon. So you can see and hear the sets of evidence that you may be unfamiliar with at that conference. And you can get there simply by going to visit richardgage911.org. Slash, well, it's on the right side. Oh dear, it's the last slide in the series of the slides at the top. 9/11 Con, the Pentagon. That was Saturday, March 19, 2022. We had a Q&A session with each of the speaker sets, and I thought it really was a great opportunity for the different sides proposing their different theories of what happened and their different evidence on that day. And it was it didn't turn out to be disharmonious. It was actually quite a coming together of opposing sides in a spirit of I think a good scientific inquiry. So I just wanted to add that.
Sure. Okay. Great. I do want to make a comment about that. I mean, you may recall, Richard, that when you kind of laid out the ground rules for the interactions that would take place in that conference, that basically required us to, and I'm sure you'll weigh in if I choose the wrong wording here or if I describe this incorrectly, but But you wanted this to be, well, you said harmonious. I guess I don't feel that, you know, when you're battling for the truth, I mean, you don't want to be rude. You don't want to hurl personal attacks for the sake of personal attacks. But you know, I said in the conference at one point, I remember pointing out two things that had been factually false in what the Chandler team had said, and I just said, these two things are false. Will you correct these false statements? And you took me to task for that because, you know, you thought I was being too perhaps disharmonious in the way I asked the question. And I recall also that
take one at a time.
Yep.
I'm guessing that it didn't go down the way you just characterized it, or I would not have, in that circumstance, called you to task. But this is a year ago, so we probably both have to catch up on what.
I'm happy to just sort of go over that again to double check. But that's how I remembered it. And what you may recall that I made a call in the middle of the conference that was, I think I spoke to Dale, but I think I was, you know, trying to reach you, whatever, because I was calling basically to object because Chandler and Costi were taking all kinds of shots at the CIT people. And these were the kinds of shots that I, you know, didn't think, you know, I thought we had been precluded from taking. And so I was sort of saying, like, you know, I just didn't think it was right that they were being allowed to get away with it. But anyway, that's not a major thing.
I remember that too, and I think I agree with you on that point.
Well, then fair enough, and good for you for that. I guess here's the problem I have, because I believe you communicated, it might have been on the website now, I can't remember now, but you made reference to that this conference should be a safe space for truthers to share their evidence. I believe those were, please correct me if I got that wrong, but I think you used that wording at some point, safe space. And my problem with that is that, and we had a discussion, you and I, on the phone about, you know, I said, well, what about this case where Wayne Costi deliberately misrepresented a quote from Craig Ranke in order to make it seem like he had the opposite belief to what he had? And I think you said it on that phone call. You said, that's fair game. You can bring that up if you want.
I would not have condoned a misrepresentation of somebody else's quote. But again, I don't remember what happened there.
See, but my concern is, I'm not trying to, this is not an attempt to nitpick or anything, but my concern is that this group, which has such a track record, and I've tried my best to document this, and I think I'm going to do more of that, because I think I've done a lot of it that people just don't know, that when we sort of create a safe space, it's like we're giving a stamp of legitimacy that may not be earned. And I would like to have had an exchange with Chandler where I could be very blunt with him, not launch personal attacks or ad hominem attacks where I just say, you know, he's a big jerk or something, but to strongly take him to task for flat out dishonest things that he's done. And you know, I won't sort of get into those now. I think I may have mentioned a couple last month, but I think at some point we need to have a venue, and other than just my blog, where we can take people to task for disingenuous and harmful behavior. And I certainly know I get I get my share of criticism for daring to go up against respected researchers like David Chandler. But I don't hear criticism of him and his tactics. And is it because people don't realize? I'm not sure. But I just don't get why that criticism isn't happening. You know, I've documented outright dishonesty in my, you know, two-part piece on Lloyd England. I mean, it's just, to me, it's not even, I don't even see that it's debatable, they're using all these fringe tactics in order to try to take away some of the best evidence that we've got. And so the whole thing was a fabrication, you know? And I honestly think that we as a movement have got to say at some point, why are these people spending 15 years pushing like just about every element of the official story that they can? And even the one part of the official story they claim not to agree with, which is who flew the planes, that's the part they never talk about. And this is a red flag, you know? The one area they depart from the official story is the one area they have the least interest in bringing to people's attention. Like, it seems like an afterthought for them. But all they want to talk about is why the official path is correct, all the official evidence is correct, the video is authentic, the radar is authentic, you know, all these things. I don't buy it. I don't buy the honesty of it. So anyway, I did appreciate it, and I do thank you for including me in that conference. I very much appreciated it. I would like if it was maybe not quite such a protected environment where it was maybe some of the things that some of the problems, you know, we didn't have the opportunity to hash out some of the things that maybe, you know, would have been productive to hash out. But anyway, I do acknowledge the value of doing such a conference. But, you know, at some point these people have, like, the fact that they're, you know, in quotes, respected, as your article sort of put it, like, at some point they've got to be criticized when criticism is due. And it can't just keep coming from, you know, five different people. Well, I mean, that's an exaggeration, but, you know, it's got to come. People have got to, you know, demand higher standards than that, I think, especially when it comes to an approach that seems to have as its goal the neutralization of this evidence. And that's, you know, they've been pretty successful at that. And that's why I keep calling attention to it and try to kind of shine a light on some of these tactics, because, you know, I mean, Sheila Casey once said on a call we had about 3 or 4 years ago that, you know, she doesn't even think that David Chandler is a truther. And I find it hard to disagree with that based on his approach regarding the Pentagon, because he seems to want to boost as much of the official stories he can possibly get away with and yet still be called somebody who isn't supporting the official story. So anyways, that was a long speech. Do you want to add anything to that, Richard?
No, I don't have anything to add. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anybody else have a question?
This is John. If you spend the time and become knowledgeable about psychological warfare operations, et cetera, which is available on the web.
Right.
One thing that you will see is that, well, there's two things. Number one, a sign of a disinformation campaign is that the existence of some kind of absurdity inside that disinformation campaign. Number two, one of the signs of a disinformation agent is someone who appears to be too intelligent to actually believe what they're telling you.
Right.
Now, since one of the purposes of disinformation campaigns is to create disharmony and discord in the target organization, you really have to think twice about engaging in combat with them, because in a sense, when you debate them, you kind of play into their hands. That's why a lot of people just ignore them, which is actually, from their standpoint, one of the worst things that you can do is to ignore them. So anyway, that's just a few thoughts. Over.
Okay, thank you. You know, it's funny, I'll just say this quickly, that I have debated what you just commented on a lot in my own head. I remember when Chandler and Jenkins got up at the 2015 9/11 Film Festival in Oakland, and both made presentations. And I actually sat there and thought, if I condemn what they said in these presentations, am I going to be helping them rather than hurting them? And I waited, and I mean, I ended up deciding that, you know, they had been doing this for years, and they were going to just keep, you know, weigh what they want, the attention, but at the same time, with no attention, they were successfully chipping away at what we had achieved as a movement for years. So even if nobody gave them attention, even if, you know, then I'm not sure that we would end up in any kind of a better situation. And so I made the decision, for better or worse, to expose some of the tactics. And it wasn't just like me saying, you know, these guys are wrong. It was showing that the subtle tactics that they use to kind of manipulate people. My hope was to expose that so that people would be able to recognize it and they wouldn't be manipulated. You know, that was the thing. Now, it may well be that that got them more active, because they certainly seemed to become more active after that. You know, Wayne Costi emerged, and he certainly had bundles of energy for sharing disinformation. I understand what you're saying, and it's a valid point, and sometimes it's a tough one. At this point, you know, especially with this new organization, I mean, you know, this organization could be serving a gatekeeping function. And if we don't, if Sandler's record in the movement isn't known to people, you know, then they can be sort of led down the garden path. That's kind of where I come down. You know, maybe history will show that I made the wrong judgment on that. I don't know. But I think people need to know what some of these tactics are. So anyway, we'll find out. But thanks for your question and your comment. Anybody else? No other questions or comments?
So what is your opinion of the Pentagon plane?
Well, my opinion is that there was no 757 impact with the building, and I made a strategic decision, going back 5 or 6 years, I came up with a list of all the truthers that were prepared to take that no 757 sort of position. And the reason that I did that was because of what I was seeing on Facebook and different other places, different discussion forums, was how, you know, the Chandler group, which might only represent a small portion of the movement, was, of course, completely united on their position. Meanwhile, the rest of the movement had dozens of different positions, missile, Global Hawk, or, you know, all kinds of different positions. And my thought was, well, if we know it wasn't a 757, then that means the official story, it can't be true. And I felt for the purposes of combating this group, I thought, well, we need to be united, as united as possible, so that we're the majority instead of them, you know, having the largest block, you know, so that most of the movement can get behind the no 757 idea. I don't see what could have happened other than the plane flying over the building. There was clearly an explosion. There seemed to be, you know, moving eyewitness evidence to suggest a plane flew right at the building. The evidence supports that plane being on a path north of the Citgo gas station, which means it couldn't have hit the light bulb and it couldn't have caused the internal damage, but it had to go somewhere. So it didn't hit the building and it had to miss the building. So that's kind of my position. But the problem the strategic decision I made was, if we say no 757 is a building, then the burden of proof is on the other side. You know, they have to prove that one did. Whereas if we take the position, you know, the flyover happened or a missile happened or whatever, then we're putting the burden of proof on ourselves. And I didn't think that was very productive. So because it's more important to absolutely prove the official story false, in my opinion, than it is to, you know, I mean, while the research continues, we may figure out exactly how it was done. And I'm sure we'll learn some new things if we keep studying it. But so that's kind of where I come down. I take the position I take both because I think it's correct and also because I think it's the right strategy. So
after 9/11, FBI agents and all other kinds of people were picking up all kinds of debris and clearing it.
Well, right. Well, all kinds of debris. I mean, a number of pieces of debris would be, you know, there was not a lot in the way of pieces that you could identify that looked like they came from a plane. There weren't that many of those. And I couldn't tell you exactly how those got in the place they did. I mean, we see those people walking around carrying pieces of supposed fuselage. Were they removing it or were they putting it in place? It's hard to tell from a photograph. But, you know, I think the smoking gun is the absence of anything that's bigger than what an individual could pick up and walk away with. I mean, I know there's a portion of what looks like an engine or a part of an engine, and I'm sure an individual couldn't walk around with that. But most of the pieces, and that's another thing, Wayne Costey refers to that one piece of that sort of famous shot that most of us have seen of that crumpled piece of metal sitting on the lawn of the Pentagon. He refers to that as a large piece of the fuselage. Well, I mean, it's large if you compare it to a dinner plate, but it's not large when you're talking about a 90-ton airplane. So that's another disingenuous sort of comment. So that's where I come down. I think there was certainly debris on the lawn, but most of it's not identifiable, and the few pieces that do look like they came from a plane, you know, I think if a real plane had hit there would have been a hell of a lot of wreckage and debris and engines. Well, you know, I don't know about engines, but wings and tail sections and all that. It's incredible the idea that we actually don't agree on whether a plane crashed into a building in the middle of rush hour traffic is absurd. A real plane would have been very obvious. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question or not.
The same as the Pittsburgh plane, Somerset Township, where there was no plane course.
Well, that's course. Right. There have been some photographs of that show, you know, in the woods that there were some pieces, but again, the official story there is that the plane, you know, hit the middle of the field and literally buried itself under the ground. And apparently it's supposed to still be under the ground. It's supposed to still be there to this day. I mean, how absurd is that? And it's not an accident that this group that I've been talking about, the Chandler group, has been, you know, in recent years, I brought it up on a teleconference 3 or 4 years ago, and maybe, you know, I don't know if that had any effect, but they were making noises about doing the same thing with Shanksville that they did with the Pentagon, and talking about how, you know, it's possible, you know, it's the evidence seems to be indicating that a plane might have gone into that field and buried itself. And, you know, it's funny because when you look at the history of their position with the Pentagon, you know, they started off by saying, well, it's possible that a plane hit the Pentagon. Then it's like, well, we can't prove one didn't. And then it's like, well, it seems like it was a large plane hit. And then it was, well, it looks like it was a 757. And eventually it was, well, we know it's Flight 77. Like, for sure, it's like, so they, it's like they just kept nudging things.
Well, my own story is on September 10th, I sent my writings to two publishers, and one was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. After 9/11, that publisher said it was related to 9/11. So, more than that, but yeah, but anyhow.
Right.
Fun part. I write all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. Good that you do. Okay, well, thanks. Does anybody else have a question or comment? Okay, it sounds like we might have exhausted those. So that's fine. If nobody has any more comments or questions, we'll move on from this. Sorry?
Okay. The real issue about 9/11 is that it is affecting the economy of the whole globe. You know, the whole globe is affected by the bank robberies. So 9/11 was the biggest bank robbery in global history until the 2020 pandemic, and that was even bigger. But that 9/11 affected the global community economy. You know, there were gold confiscates, banned drug confiscates. There was inside trading. A lot of money related to 9/11. A lot of bank robberies. Put options, like a lot of money is related to 9/11. Money.
Well, that's the effect is still being felt for sure in many ways, and that's why we keep going. So thanks, Vern. Thanks for that. Anybody else before we move on to announcements? Okay, sounds like we don't have anything else. We'll move to announcements. Does anybody have any announcements that they would like to share with the group? Okay. Sounds like not, so that's fine. So, all right. Now, I'll just we'll close it here, and I'll just remind everybody that our next call is the last Wednesday in August. That's going to be August the 30th, and that is going to be our first Zoom call, and I hope it's all successful so that we'll want to keep doing it that way. So that, you know, you'll all be, when you get the agenda, which I hope you'll get by the Sunday before, which would be the 27th, and it will include a link to the call. So this will require, I guess, going through. Well, I won't say what it will require because, I'm not the most savvy person when it comes to this. I'm going to be doing some learning of my own in the meantime, so this will all move smoothly. But so that's going to happen, and you'll be all informed about that well in advance. So I'll leave this here. Thank everybody for participating, and we'll see you all on August 30th.
Okay.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
All right, good night.
Night now.